This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Riot House, Book 1 of Crooked Sinners, written by Callie Hart, performed by Jillian Macy and CJ Mission.
Prologue. I can't move. Not even an inch. The foul smell of rot seeping through the tiny holes in front of my face makes me gag. I've thrown up 4 times in, I don't know how long it's been. But that isn't even the worst part of this nightmare. The worst part is the terror of not knowing when he's coming back. Night turns into day, turns into night. Turns into day. My knees and my hips and my shoulders scream, constricted and long dead from lack of blood flow. I think perhaps I might die. Dying would be preferable to this. But I don't. I keep on breathing, my mind spiraling away from me. Until my thoughts are unrecognizable noise. And all I can do is kneel here. All I can do is wait.
1. Elodie. Thank fuck it's dark. Nothing could be worse than arriving at a new school in broad daylight. The Lincoln Town car jolts as it hits a dip in the road, and a wave of panic lights me up. An immediate, unfortunate response to the last 2 years that I've spent living in a war zone. And no, I'm not talking about the fact that my previous home in Israel occasionally felt like a war zone. I'm referring to the fact that I was living under the same roof as my father, Colonel Stillwater, whose idea of a relaxing weekend was beating me black and blue during our Krav Maga training sessions. I still flinch every time I hear someone politely clear their throat. When Daddy Dearest clears his throat, it usually means I'm about to endure humiliation at his hands, or some form of embarrassment, or both.
Looks like they left the lights on for you, Miss Elodie. The driver says through the open privacy window.
This is the first thing he's mumbled to me since he collected me at the airport, bundled me into the back of this gleaming black monstrosity, gunned the engine, and headed north for the town of Mountain Lakes, New Hampshire. Up ahead, a building looms like a proud, ominous sentinel out of the dark, all sharp, tall spires and turrets. Looks like something out of the pages of a Victorian Penny Dreadful. I avoid peering out of the window at the stately structure for too long. I glared at the academic pamphlet Colonel Stillwater shoved at me when he unceremoniously informed me that I'd be relocating stateside without him, for long enough that the Academy's imposing facade is already burned into my memory in intricate detail. Tennis courts, swimming pool, fencing studio, debate lounge, a library commemorated by George Washington himself in 1793. It all looked great in print, only the height of luxury for a Stillwater. That's what my father said gruffly as he threw my single small suitcase into the back of the cab that would whisk me away from my life in Tel Aviv. I saw straight through the building's state-of-the-art facilities and its well-heeled, old-money veneer, though. This place isn't a regular school for regular kids. It's a jail cell, dressed up as a place of learning, where army officers who can't be bothered dealing with their own kids dump them without a second thought, knowing that they'll be watched over with a military-like focus. Wolf Hall. Jesus. Even the name sounds like it belongs to a fucking prison. Mentally, I'm backing up, moving further away from the place with every passing second. By the time the car pulls up in front of the sweeping marble steps that lead to the academy's daunting front entrance, I'm back on the road behind me, 3 miles away, fleeing my new reality. At least that's where I would be if I had absolutely any choice in this whatsoever. I wasn't exactly popular back in Tel Aviv, but I had friends. Eden, Ayala, and Levi won't even realize that I've been transferred from my old school for another 24 hours. It's already too late for them to come and rescue me from my fate. I knew I was a lost cause before the wheels on the army plane went up back in Tel Aviv. The town car's engine cuts out abruptly, plummeting the car into an awkward, unfriendly silence that makes my ears ring. Eventually, I realize that the driver's waiting for me to get out. I'll get my bags then, I suppose. I don't want to be here. I sure as hell shouldn't have to lug my own bags out of the trunk of a car. I'd never rat on the driver. That's just weak. But my father would have an aneurysm if he found out the guy he hired as my escort hadn't done his job properly once we reached our dreaded destination. As if the guy realizes this too, he reluctantly hauls his ass out of the car and heads for the rear of the vehicle, dumping my belongings onto the small sidewalk in front of Wolf Hall. He then has the audacity to wait for a tip, which just plain isn't happening. Who aids and abets in the destruction of someone's life and then expects a thank you and $100 bill for their troubles? I'm 3 parts gasoline, 1 part match, as I snatch up my stuff and begin the hike up the steps toward Wolf Hall's formidable double oak doors. The marble is worn, bowing in the middle and smooth from the thousands of feet that have trudged up and down these steps over the years. But I'm too sour right now to enjoy the delightfully satisfying feel of them underfoot. The driver has already gotten back in the car and is swinging out of the turning circle in front of the academy when I reach the very top step. A part of me wants to dump my bags and run after him. He isn't one of Colonel Stillwater's regular employees. He's an agency guy, so he doesn't owe my old man anything. If I offered him a couple of grand, he might be persuaded to drop me off in another state somewhere, far from my father's prying eyes. My pride won't let me beg, though. I'm a Stillwater, after all. Our pride is our most notorious trait. My only means of escape burns off down the driveway, leaving me faced with 2 heavy brass knockers, one mounted onto each of the double doors in front of me. The knocker on the left, a grotesque gargoyle clasping a patinaed ring in his downturned mouth. The knocker on the right is almost identical, except for the fact that his mouth is turned up in a leering, garish smile that sends a chill deep into my bones. "Creepy much?" I mutter, grabbing hold of the knocker on the left. The sad gargoyle's far from pleasing to look at, but at least it doesn't look like it's about to leap down from its mounting and devour my fucking soul. A resounding boom thunders on the other side of the door when I slam the knocker against the wood. And I realize with a sense of irony that the noise is similar to that of a gavel being struck, sealing a criminal's fate.
"Wouldn't bother knocking. It's open."
Holy shit. I nearly jump out of my fucking skin. Spinning around, my legs nearly quit on me as I scan the darkness, searching for the owner of the voice that just startled the ever-loving shit out of me. It takes a second, but I locate the shadowy figure, perched on the rim of a white stone planter off to the right. Thanks to the pop and flare of a glowing ember, looks like the cherry of a cigarette. "Jesus, I didn't know there was anyone out here." I put a hand against my chest, as if the action will slow my jackrabbiting heart.
"Figured,"
the deep voice rumbles. And it is a deep voice, the voice of a man who smoked more than a few packs of cigarettes in his day. It's the kind of voice that belongs to a car thief or a back alley gambler. The cherry of his cigarette flares again as he pulls on it, momentarily illuminating the structure of his features, and I catch a lot in the brief swell of light. His black t-shirt is at least 5 sizes too big for him. He's way younger than I thought. Instead of a disgruntled, jaded professor in a moth-eaten blazer with patches on the elbows, this guy is young, my age by the looks of things. He must be a student here at Wolf Hall. His dark hair hangs down into his eyes. His brows are full and drawn together into a steep frown. From my vantage point at the top of the stairs, I can only see him in profile, but his nose is straight, his jaw is strong, and he holds himself in a regal, lazy way that lets me know exactly who he is before I've even learned his name. He's one of those kids. The arrogant, cooler than cool, silver spoon halfway up his ass kids. It's part and parcel of being an army brat. You get lumped in with the privileged and the spoiled rotten on a daily basis. And you get to recognize the bad apples from a fucking mile away. I take it I need to find someone at reception, I ask. Best to keep it short and sweet, as professional as possible. The guy shakes his head, picking a piece of tobacco from the tip of his tongue and flicking it onto the gravel at his feet.
I was appointed director of the New Girl Welcoming Committee. Why else would I be sitting out here in the fucking dark?
Ladies and gentlemen, we have ourselves a shitty attitude. Yay. Folding my arms across my chest, I descend the steps slowly, leaving my bags by the door. Arriving in front of him, I note that the stranger is at least a clear foot taller than me. Even slouching, his ass perched on the edge of the planter, legs stretched out in front of him, he's considerably taller than me, and I'm standing at my full height.
Because you smoke like a chimney and you don't want to get busted?
He flicks his cigarette, smirking coldly. Everything about him is cold, from the icy glint in his bright green eyes to the way he drops his head back, assessing me like a mountain lion might weigh up a newborn deer. Clearly, he resents having to wait up and play Wolf Hall's amicable host. But hey, I didn't ask him to be my tour guide. I haven't asked anything of him at all. Point me in the direction of my room and I'll relieve you of your duties then, I tell him in a clipped tone. He laughs at this. It's not a friendly sound. I imagine scores of people have been laughed at by this boy, and every single one of them probably felt like they were being run through with a bayonet.
Relieve me of my duties.
He repeats my words back to me.
At ease, soldier. Why do I get the feeling that our parents would be best fucking friends?
These schools aren't always full of army kids. Investment bankers, lawyers, diplomats, and politicians pack their kids off to places like Wolf Hall, too. From time to time, a harried doctor or an aid worker. Who thinks caring for other people's kids is more important than caring for their own? The students at these places come from a diverse range of backgrounds. But more often than not, their parents are military. Look, I just got off a long-haul flight, and not the kind that had a meal service or clean bathrooms. I need a shower and I need a bed. Can you just tell me where I need to go and we can continue this bullshit at a later date? The guy tugs on his cigarette one last time, huffing down his nose. When he flicks the glowing butt off into the rose bushes 10 feet away, I notice that he's wearing chipped black nail polish. Weird. His shirt's black, and he definitely seems tetchy as hell. But I'm not getting an emo vibe from him. His boots are tan, high-end Italian leather, and the belt around his waist looks like it cost more than my entire outfit. Through the doors, stairs on the left, fourth floor. You're in 416. Good luck with the heating, he says, getting to his feet. Without even looking back at me, he takes off, but not back inside the building. He hits the driveway, sticking his hands in his pockets as he heads away from the school. Hey, where the hell are you going? I hate that I call after him, but I need to know. I'm so intensely jealous that he's leaving that I have to clamp my tongue between my teeth to stop myself from asking if I can go with him. Huh, like I bored here, he tosses over his shoulder. Oh, and don't worry, new girl. We don't need to continue this bullshit later. Keep your head down, keep out of the way, and you'll have a decent chance of surviving this hellhole. It could just be that I'm tired, and it could be that I'm hating Wolf Hall already, but that sounded distinctly like a threat. 2. Elodie. The inside of Wolf Hall looks like someone tried to recreate Hogwarts from memory, but got it really, really wrong. There are dark alcoves everywhere I turn, and none of the angles in the place are plumb. I feel like I'm walking through some sort of trippy Escher nightmare as I make my way through the austere wood-paneled entranceway and head for the broad staircase on the right-hand side. I check, hopefully, for an elevator, but I already know that such a thing would be an impossible luxury in an old building like this. The place is silent as the grave. I've been in plenty of old houses before. They creak, and they groan, and they settle. But not Wolf Hall. It's as if the very building itself is holding its breath, peering down on me and casting judgment as it observes me reluctantly wrangling my suitcase up the first flight of stairs. The place didn't look that tall from outside, but the stairs never seem to fucking end. I'm panting and clammy by the time I hit the second set of stairs, and by the third, I'm openly sweating and laboring for breath. Through an ancient door with frosted glass panels, I find myself staring down a narrow hallway straight out of The Shining. A dim light overhead flickers ominously as I drag my bag over the dusty, threadbare runner that covers the bare floorboards, and I mentally tick off all the ways that a person could die in a haunted-ass place like this. I notice the brass numbers screwed into each of the doors as I pass them. Normally, there'd be colorful stickers and nameplates tacked onto the wood, little personalizations that help the students make their rooms feel like home. Not here, though. There isn't a sticker, photograph, or poster in sight. Just the dark, depressing wood and the gleaming, polished numbers. 410. 412, 414, 416. Great. Home sweet home. I open up the door, glad to find it unlocked. Inside, the bedroom's bigger than I expected it to be. In the corner, a double bed has been made up with crisp gray sheets, complete with military corners. Only two pillows, but I can live with that. Against the wall, a large chest of drawers underneath a grim-looking painting of a gnarled old man bent double against a howling blizzard. Such a weird choice of subject matter for a piece of art. Technically, it's good. The brushwork is so fine and precise that it could almost be a photograph. The content's miserable, however, and inspires a sense of hopelessness that feels crushing. On the far side of the room, a large bay window overlooks what I assume are the gardens to the rear of the academy. The world's dark, all bruised purples and midnight blues, punctuated with coal black. But I can make out the shape of tall trees in the distance, still, as if no breeze, no matter how strong, could shake them. I discard my bags at the foot of my new bed, walking to the window, wanting to get a better look at the view. It's only when I'm standing right in front of the glass that I can make out the gloomy shape of a large, complex maze in the center of the lawn, between the building and the trees. A maze? Perfect. That wasn't on the damn brochure. It has to be very old, though, because the hedges are tall, taller than any man, and so dense that there would be no way to peek through them on ground level. I don't know why, but I shiver violently at the sight of it. I've never been a fan of mazes. At least from here, in the daylight, I'll be able to memorize the route to its center. Not that I plan on going inside the damn thing. The showers are easy enough to find. At the end of the hall, two bathrooms face opposite each other, doors propped wide open. A large white sign hangs from the tiled wall inside both. I know because I check, which says, 3-minute showers enforced. Violators assigned latrine duty. Latrine duty? Christ, it's worse than I thought. I give the sign a hard eye roll as I strip out of my travel clothes and shower, taking way longer than the allotted 3 minutes. Who the hell's going to know? And fuck it anyway. They can't police that kind of shit with a student who hasn't even officially enrolled at the academy yet. I use the carbolic soap attached to a frayed piece of rope inside the shower, wrinkling my nose at the smell and promising myself a better wash with my own shower gel in the morning. Then I use a scratchy, paper-thin towel to dry off before putting on my PJs and hurrying back to my room with wet hair. I already have plans to dye my long blonde locks dark brown again. Most fathers wouldn't want their daughters bleaching their hair at 17 years old. But Colonel Stillwater can't stand the sight of me with my natural hair coloring. He'd never admit it in a million years, but he can't handle me with brown hair. I look too much like her with brown hair. Short of forcing me to wear contacts, he can't alter the blue of my eyes. There's little he can do about the freckles that smatter the bridge of my nose or the bone structure of my heart-shaped face. Without dropping some serious coin on a very talented plastic surgeon, he can't alter my high cheekbones or my almond-shaped eyes, all of which are gifts I received from my mother. But he could make me a blonde, and so he did. And I've hated every second of it. Back in my room, I notice for the first time how bitterly cold it is. Compared to Tel Aviv, it's practically subarctic here in New Hampshire. And it doesn't seem as though the Wolf Hall administration have deemed heating a necessity for its students. After a lot of rummaging, I eventually find a cracked and yellowed Bakelite thermostat in the closet by the window. But when I crank the dial all the way to the right, nothing happens. The old-fashioned and extremely ugly radiator on the wall gives a single choked cough, a bone-jarring rattle, and then falls resolutely silent. Luckily, I'm so tired that even the cold can't keep me from sleep. 3. Elodie. The morning smells like rust and burning toast. I crack my eyes and wince at the plume of fog that gathers on my breath. Somehow, it's even colder in my room at 7 a.m., which is impressive since I'm convinced it dropped down to somewhere in the 20s in the night. If my father cared one iota about me, he would not have sprung this transition on me mid-semester. The smallest kindness he could have shown me would have been to relocate me during a break. But no. Colonel Stillwater decided that uprooting me out of the blue on a weekend was the best course of action. Far be it from me to disrupt his schedule, since he needed to disappear off on a training exercise at 0400 hours on a Sunday. It seemed perfectly logical to turn my shit upside down and expect me to be fine with moving country, having my world turned upside down, and starting class at a new school, all within a 32-hour period. This is the least of his sins. He has done much, much worse. So here we are, Monday morning, my new life. From the strict itinerary my father shoved into my backpack, I'm supposed to be downstairs at the administration offices 20 minutes before my first period of the day, which leaves me 40 minutes to get myself showered, dressed, and organized. Since I showered last night, I normally wouldn't bother showering again, but I still feel gross from the journey somehow. And honestly, I think I'm going to need to soak my feet in some scalding hot water in order to defrost them anyway. It's only the middle of January. It's probably going to get colder before it gets any warmer here in New Hampshire. So I'm definitely going to have to do something about the climate control in this room. I pull back the thin sheets, my teeth chattering uncontrollably. And I make sure to grab my own towel and my wash bag this time. In the hallway, a number of the doors to the other rooms are open, and a line of girls has formed against either wall, waiting for the bathrooms. My heart sinks. Things were miserable at home, but at least I had my own fucking bathroom. Having to share the facilities at Wolf Hall is going to take some getting used to. I join the end of the line, waiting for the bathroom on the right-hand side of the hallway, and the girls ahead of me fall quiet in unison. 8 pairs of baleful eyes look me up and down. None of the girls seem all too friendly. One of my new classmates angles away from the redhead she was locked in conversation with and turns to me, offering me half a smile. Her brown hair is curled tightly into an enviable afro. Her skin is almost as pale as mine, though. Her doe-eyed features and deep brown eyes give her the look of a young Natalie Portman.
Hey, 416, right? You must be Elodie.
I give her a tight-lipped smile in return. Guilty as charged. This whole new girl thing isn't actually new. I've had to do this at least 4 other times since I reached high school age. It's been a while, though. After 3 whole years back at my last school in Tel Aviv, I allowed myself to get comfortable. Big mistake.
I'm Karina, the girl says, holding out her hand. Glad you made it here in one piece. Some of us waited up for you last night, but it got late and...
She shrugs. I shake her hand, a little warmed by the idea that some of the girls here might have shown me that kindness, had the hour allowed. All good, I totally get it.
Curfew here's pretty strict, the redhead chips in. She's tall, like really tall.
Almost as tall as the miserable bastard who gave me directions to my room last night.
We have to be in our rooms by 10:30, she says. Although Miriam, our floor monitor, turns a blind eye sometimes if we bribe her with chocolate. It's cold as shit up here, but count yourself lucky. First floor girls don't have it so easy. Their floor monitor's a fucking bitch.
Hey, the girl first in line for my bathroom snaps. Watch your mouth, Prez. Some of us are friends with Sarai.
How could I forget?
Prez. The redhead fires back, pulling a face at her.
You're shoved so far up her ass, it's a miracle you haven't earned your sphincter patrol badge yet, Damiana.
Damiana's a cool name. Shame the girl herself doesn't seem that cool. She's 3 shades blonder than me and wearing a full face of makeup even before she's stepped foot inside the bathroom. Maybe all that eyeliner is tattooed on.
Wow, your comebacks are getting a little better, Satan spawn. Still need work, though. Maybe you need to practice in the mirror some more.
The bathroom door opens, and a beautiful girl with a mass of black curls and cinnamon-colored skin steps out, dressed in a towel. She immediately rolls her eyes.
God, not even 7:30 and you're already sniping, Dami. Give it a rest.
Damiana growls as she shoves her way into the bathroom, nearly knocking the other girl off her feet.
Rashida, this is Elodie, Karina says, nodding in my direction. Hiking her towel up and pinning it under her arm, Rashida gives me a perfunctory shake of the hand, too.
"We'll talk once you hit the 3-month mark," she says, then hurries off down the hall, walking into room 410 and slamming the door closed behind her.
"Sorry about her," Karina says, leaning back against the wall. "The last couple of girls who arrived mid-semester all transferred out again pretty quick. I suppose making the effort to get to know people, if you're not sure they're going to stick around, is more difficult for some of us than others."
"Transferred out?"
Prez says, her eyebrows rising up her forehead. She sounds as if she disagrees with the term Karina used, but the other girl shoots her a sharp look.
"Don't," she warns.
"Not yet. Jesus, let the girl settle in a little first before you go dredging up that shit, yeah?"
This has me slightly worried. Dredging up what shit?
Nothing. Karina says this firmly, eyeing the other girls. She's daring them to open their mouths and breathe another word, which none of them do. Apparently, they're willing to defer to Karina because everyone standing in the hallway, press included, looks down at their feet.
Okay.
If there's one thing I hate, aside from my father, it's secrets.
There have been so many in my past, far too many things kept from me over the years, that I have a really low tolerance for this kind of shit. It's my first day, though. I just met these girls 10 minutes ago. I can't go demanding 100% candor from them before I've even properly learned their names. I do my best to shrug it off.
"Hey, knock on my door before you go down, okay?" Karina offers. "I'm student-teacher liaison. I can take you to the office and grab your paperwork with you. And then we can head to English together if you like. I think a lot of our classes are going to match up."
I might be small in stature, but I'm still a big girl. I'm perfectly capable of finding my own way to the office and on to class. I learned my lesson a long time ago, though. If someone offers you an olive branch in the cutthroat waters of international schooling, you grab hold of that fucker and you don't let go.
"Sure, thanks. That'd be cool." The excursion to the office is uneventful, which is to say that the world doesn't end while I'm filling out my health questionnaire and grabbing all of the reading lists and mandatory textbook titles I'll need to order for my classes. Karina acts as mediator between myself and the decrepit, mostly deaf octogenarian behind the desk, shouting when the poor old girl can't hear my responses. The lenses on her glasses are so thick that they make her eyes look 8 times their normal size. Despite the visual aid, she squints at me over the top of a stack of paperwork like it might actually help her hear me better. Once we're done, Karina snatches the map the administrator gave me out of my hands and tosses it straight into the trash, dragging me down a long, crooked hallway lined with bunches of flowers in vases.
"Won't be needing that," she sing-songs.
"You have me to be your personal Wolf Hall tour guide. I can tell we're gonna get on just fine. I knew the moment I saw the fishnets." I glance down at the fishnet tights she's referring to. I'm wearing them under my favorite pair of ripped jean shorts. The Doc Marten boots I picked out are potentially overkill, but my look wouldn't be complete without them. I know it's cold, but my outrageous clothes were first in a long line of protests I have planned for my stay at Wolf Hall. Tragically, when I came out of my room and saw Karina's clothes, it became apparent that the students here can wear whatever the hell they feel like and get away with it. Her bright yellow bomber jacket and red jeans clash so violently, there's a risk I'll develop a migraine soon just from looking at her. The other students' clothes are a confusion of different styles and colors, too. There are enough ripped jeans and band t-shirts kicking around to make it look like we're all about to walk through the gates of a music festival.
Quickly adding two and two together, I realize that Karina's taking me straight to class. Shouldn't I drop my stuff off at my locker first? Psh, we don't have lockers. If you don't want to carry a bag around with you, you're going to have to run up to your room between periods. And trust me, there is not enough time for that shit. Come on, you'll be fine. The room falls silent when Karina coerces me into English. Heads whip around, conversations come to a grinding halt. And the hairs on the back of my neck stand to attention. On a battered leather couch, underneath a massive picture window, the guy from last night is laid out like he downed a bunch of Special K for breakfast and the drugs have just kicked in. He's the first thing I notice. The second thing I notice, there aren't any desks. Well, not in the traditional sense, anyway. A little stunned, I gape at the room as I take it all in. The armoires, the ottomans, the overstuffed armchairs, and the worn old writing desks dotted around the vast space. Most surprisingly, there are book stacks toward the rear of the room, wooden benches, and lo and behold, there is a monster of a fire roaring in the open fireplace. I've never seen anything like it before in my entire life. What? Our English class is in the library? A chorus of snickers go up, courtesy of the other students draped over the armchairs and leaning against the writing desks. Two guys sitting on the floor by the other large window trade a droll look, as if this whole "what the hell is going on" bit is really old to them. I feel like I've just walked into Doctor Who's TARDIS and made the mistake of exclaiming, "Wait a second, it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside." Karina kicks the boot of one of the guys sitting on the floor as she leads me past them toward an empty floral print couch. He lunges forward, baring his teeth and snapping them at her, but she ignores his performance. "No, the library's way bigger than this. This is Doc Fitzpatrick's den, as he likes to call it. He's basically a god around here. Gets away with murder. He's supposed to take his classes in the room they assigned him in the English block, but he says it's easier to inspire his students in a more relaxed setting." This is relaxed, all right. I've never even seen a sofa in a teacher's classroom before, let alone planted my ass on one. "Hey, Karina, who's that?" I jerk my chin in the direction of the guy who gave me such a warm reception last night. He's taken one of the floral print cushions from the couch he's lying on and has placed it over his face. Karina stills, arching an eyebrow at me in a way that makes me feel like I've made yet another faux pas. Yeah. That is Ren Jacoby. He's more feral dog than human being. Honestly, she sighs heavily, making herself busy by pulling a large notebook out of the bag at her feet. "I'd tell you to stay away from him, but it's kind of impossible to avoid anyone in this place. Plus, Ren has a way of bullying his way into your business, whether you like it or not, so..." Wrinkling my nose, I tilt my head to one side, squinting at him. "You know, I'm pretty sure he's wearing the same clothes he was in last night." This earns me a brittle laugh. "Yeah, he is." How the hell does Karina know what he was wearing last night? Unless... She said a few of the girls waited up for me. She was obviously waiting with him. He said he'd drawn the short straw and had to stay awake until I arrived. I don't know the first thing about the guy other than he smokes, but somehow I can't imagine Ren hanging out with a bunch of girls waiting to greet a new Wolf Hall student. "Ren and his guys, they like to fuck with people, Elodie. And when no one's willing to play their stupid games, to live by their stupid rules, they'll fuck with each other instead. Pax bet him he couldn't bag 10 girls before Christmas break, and when he failed the challenge, his friends told him he had to wear the same clothes for an entire month when we came back. So, yeah, Ren's definitely wearing the same clothes he was wearing last night. He's wearing the same clothes he was wearing 2 weeks ago. I think they let him wash them every couple of days, but you can bet your ass he'll be wearing the same black shirt tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that, right up until February 1st. Because the only thing worse than losing a bet to a Riot House boy is failing to settle the bill when they lose, no matter what it costs them or who gets hurt along the way. Riot House boy? Yeah, Karina scowls. Those three idiots have a house halfway down the mountain. They call it Riot House. Everyone does. They're allowed to live there for some unknown fucking reason, while the rest of us have to shiver our asses off here during the winter months and cook during the summer. The Academy has off-campus housing? Karina's bemused by my confusion. No, Ren's loaded. His family owns the place, or he does. I've never been clear on the details. All I know is that they can do whatever the hell they want down there, and the rest of us have to stay up here and toe the line. There's a bitter note in Karina's voice. She's plastered a sunny smile on her pretty face when she looks up from her bag, though. Anyway, Pax, Dashiell, and especially Ren, watch out for them, is all I'm saying, girl. You'll wind up regretting it otherwise. I can promise you that. Pretty speech, Carrie. Glad to see you're giving lovely little Elodie Stillwater the lay of the land. Neither of us have noticed the guy who was sitting on the floor get up and walk over to us. He's handsome in the same dangerous way that snakes and spiders and wolves are beautiful to look at. His hair is shaved back to dark stubble. Tattoos peek out from beneath his long-sleeved white t-shirt. His blue eyes spark like they're brimming over with live electricity when they home in on me, pinning me to the back of the couch. I feel like I've wrapped my hand around a live wire and I can't let go. Go fuck yourself, Pax, Karina hisses through her teeth. It's the first time I've heard her sound anything other than friendly, and the venom dripping from her words takes my breath away. She doesn't just dislike this guy. She fucking hates him. Pax rakes his bottom lip through his teeth in the weirdest display I've ever seen, his ice blue eyes drilling into Karina. There's something overtly carnal about the energy rolling off him, and it makes the skin on my arms break out in goosebumps. I don't like it, but I can't seem to tear my eyes away from him. To his right, the friend Pax was sitting with groans loudly, getting to his feet. Where Pax looks like an ex-convict with his tattoos, his shaved head, and his bizarre attitude, this guy, who can only be Dashiell, looks like a librarian. Dressed in a white button-down shirt and tight-fitting gray pants, the guy took care in getting ready before coming to class today. The thick, black-rimmed glasses he's wearing give him the air of someone who likes to read. A sweeping, nonsensical generalization, but the quick intelligence in his tawny hazel eyes seems to back up this theory. Like his eyes, his hair is more than one color, light brown from one angle, but when he turns his head to look at me, it transforms to dirty blonde. Sorry, ladies, Pax doesn't know how to behave himself around such beauty. He drank a little too much coffee this morning, too, so you'll have to understand if he's acting out a little. Oh, wow. English accent. Smooth as silk, Dashiell's voice is immediately soothing. He holds himself with confidence and certainty, as if he's sure of his place in the world and precisely how he fits into it. It's a neat trick, the confidence thing. In a weird way, it makes him feel safe, whereas Pax feels entirely the opposite.
Karina squirms, eyes fixed on a stack of books on the other side of the room, carefully avoiding Dashiell's gaze. Her reaction to Pax was open hostility, but now she seems to have shrunk in on herself, shutting down altogether.
Carrie, you're not going to introduce us to your new friend? Dashiell purrs.
My new friend's stiff as a board. She looks like she's about to topple sideways off the couch, so I save her from replying. You already know who I am. Wolf Hall isn't exactly a big place. Plus, he just called me by my name, I say, eyes darting over to Pax. I'm Elodie Stillwater. I transferred in from Tel Aviv. Father's an army man. Mother's dead. I'm into painting, music, and photography. I'm allergic to pineapple. I'm an only child. I'm terrified of thunderstorms, and I love flea markets. There, that enough information for you? I list off these random facts about myself with a smile on my face, but it's saccharine sweet and false as all hell. Pax huffs out a breath of derisive laughter, while Dashiell's response to my big speech is to turn his full attention on me, a slow, calculating smile spreading across his face. He's quick and clever, this one. You can practically see the cogs whirring in his head as he files away the data I just supplied. Why, all of a sudden, does it seem like a huge mistake that I handed over those unimportant facts about myself?
Pleased to meet you, Elodie Stillwater. It's always nice to make a new friend. Maybe you'd like to come over to Riot House sometime. We'd love to extend our hospitality to you. At the same time, two voices speak out, one rushed and urgent, the other audibly bored. She can't. Not happening, Dash.
The owner of the first voice, sitting next to me, flinches. I don't think Karina meant to blurt out her objections so loudly. She looks sheepish as she takes my hand, lacing her fingers through mine.
You know she'll get in trouble if Harcourt finds out, she says.
On the couch, with his face still buried beneath a cushion, Ren Jacoby growls,
"She's not invited."
The way he says it makes it sound like a decree, an order passed down from on high that is expected to be observed. Dashiell lets out a morose sigh. He sounds honestly disappointed.
Don't worry, Stillwater. Jacoby changes his mind like he changes his socks. His current state of attire notwithstanding, of course. He's usually very good about changing his socks. I think that's the thing I like most about him. All right, class, asses on a flat surface. Move, move, move.
At the front of the room, a tall guy wearing a tight black dress shirt and a black pencil tie kicks out the wooden wedge that was holding the door open and boots the door closed behind him as he whirls into the room. In his mid-30s, the guy is throwing off some heavy Clark Kent vibes. His jaw's so sharp, it looks like it could cut and draw blood. Dark, wavy hair and dark eyes. I can see why half the girls in the room melt into their seats when they realize he's arrived. Dr. Fitzpatrick, my new English professor, is a stone-cold smoke show.
Ren, cushion off the face, man. Sit the fuck up. You know the rules, he commands,
setting down a pile of papers onto a bookshelf. There's a coffee cup in his other hand, which he drinks deeply from, the muscles in his throat working as he drains the contents of the cup in one go. Miraculously, Ren drags the cushion from his face and heaves himself upright into a seated position. He glares daggers at Doc Fitzpatrick while he does it, but he complies. This is unexpected, very unexpected indeed. Ren gives off the impression that he doesn't obey anyone. I certainly wouldn't have expected him to obey an authority figure like an English professor. Horrified, a number of things dawn on me in quick succession. It was so dark last night that I hadn't gotten a proper look at Ren.
In the light that had flared off the cherry of his cigarette, I'd reluctantly acknowledged the fact that he was good-looking. But in the daylight, with the weak sun flooding in through the massive picture window right behind his head, I can see so much more of him now. And I'm so desperately, absolutely beyond fucking fucked. He's beautiful. His black hair curls around his ears like it was painted onto his head, the artful strokes of a master's brush. It's thick and disheveled, and my fingers curl inwards of their own volition, wanting to feel the texture of it as I curl my hand into a fist. His eyes are green, vivid and frighteningly bright. Jade, the color of fresh new grass, and limes, and spring awakening after winter. They look borderline unreal. His mouth is unusual. His top lip is slightly fuller than the bottom, which should look odd on a guy. But Ren manages to make a sensual feminine mouth look cruel. I drink in the sight of him, the way his muscles shift between his shoulder blades as he braces himself on the edge of the leather couch, and he pulls himself forward to lean with his forearms resting on the top of his knees. The way he smirks savagely when his quick eyes flit over the room and he catches a girl with braids looking at him. The way he steeples his fingers, all of him coming alive, like he's just been activated, when Dr. Fitzpatrick says, "Okay, fuck-ups, listen close. I read your assignments, and they were very interesting, very raw and emotional, very real, and some were just plain graphic." "What do you mean, graphic?" a girl sitting on an ottoman at the front asks. "The essay was on Victorian morality in English literature." "Yes, Damiana, yes, it was." "Oh, great." I can only see the back of her head from where I'm sitting. I hadn't realized I was in the same class as the viper from this morning. Dr. Fitzpatrick rocks his head from side to side, turning back to his stack of papers. He shuffles through the stapled documents on the top until he finds the one he's looking for. "This piece is titled The Repressed Governess and went 4,000 words over our 2,000-word limit. I've highlighted a number of sections that I thought were rather enlightening." He makes a show of clearing his throat, then begins reading from the assignment. "So innocent before, now she looks terrified. The fear in her eyes made his shaft harden in his pants as he prowled forward, intent on bagging her directly into his trap. Her chest rose and fell so rapidly, her large breasts were in danger of brimming over the top of her corset. Nothing could be more titillating to him than the sight of her accidentally disrobed and made vulnerable before him. The anticipation rose in him now, as it always did when he was so close to accomplishing his nefarious goals. For months, he'd labored, working on the governess, knowing her church, her faith, and her lunatic father would keep her from acting on her darkest desires. And still, he hadn't given up. He'd seen the wicked fire burning in her soul, and he was determined to unleash it and set it free. The governess cried out when her back hit the wall. She knew she was cornered, and there was no way out. No sooner had she realized her situation than she accepted it, though. Her breath quickened further, this time from excitement. There was something to be said about relinquishing control of oneself to a monster in a black top hat. And now that he was fast approaching with such a look of menace in his eyes, the governess discovered that she wasn't as afraid of her undeniable fate as she had first thought. She witnessed the threatening bulge of his staff pressing against the front of his trousers. She saw the way he groped at himself, squeezing himself in the most lurid way, and surprised as she was, she knew that she was wet between her legs, her cunny slick with want as...
Dr. Fitzpatrick cuts off, dropping his hands to his sides. Exasperated, he shakes his head.
Honestly, I have to say I'm impressed with the prose. Great use of the word lurid. And cunny? You must have had to look that one up, Jacoby.
All eyes turn to Ren. Of course he wrote it. I am the most unsurprised person in the world. It totally tracks that this devil in a black t-shirt handed in Victorian porn as his English assignment. He doesn't look the slightest bit remorseful as he levels his steady gaze on the doc.
I did, he says. The internet's a remarkable place. All kinds of weird shit, if you know what you're looking for.
You do realize that this piece was supposed to be on the Victorian sense of morality, right? Dr. Fitzpatrick asks.
Ren shrugs. I do, and they had none. The Victorians were just as horny, depraved, and dirty as we are. They were just better at hiding it. There were just as many filthy books about fucking back then as there were books about sweet, subjugated women who lived by strict rules of propriety. They just didn't get the same kind of press.
So, you're saying women were painted as weak, subjugated creatures in a lot of Victorian literature?
Ren sighs wearily, like he shouldn't have to explain any of this. I'm not saying it. It's what happened. Austen made out like women back then were virtuous, good, wholesome creatures who never once thought about getting laid. It was all a lie, Fitz. Women have liked to get fucked since the dawn of time, just like guys. The fact that the Victorians used to guard that little tidbit like it was some huge fucking secret makes them even kinkier than us.
Dr. Fitzpatrick's eyebrows inch up. I think he's unimpressed by Ren's argument, but also grudgingly impressed by it, too. Tossing the paper at Ren, the doc sends the sheaf of paper fluttering down to the boy's feet.
Do it again. 48 hours, Jacoby. Stick to the assignment brief, or you'll find yourself doing it over for a third time. This will be your Groundhog Day of essays until you do it right. And no curse words. You should know by now that shock tactics won't work with me.
Ren leaves his assignment on the thin Persian rug at his feet. Most guys would be irritated by the fact that they had to rewrite an essay from the beginning, but he doesn't seem to care. He's taking the whole thing completely in stride.
Shock tactics work on everyone. I just haven't found the right level of shocking for you yet, Fitz. I'm nothing if not persistent. Leave it with me. I'll figure it out before the end of term.
God, this guy's a pro at concocting statements that sound like thinly disguised threats. I wonder if he speaks this way to his parents. My father would knock my head off my shoulders if I dared speak to him, or any of my teachers, that way. Ren might have army personnel for folks, but we must have had a very different upbringing if he knows he can get away with this shit. Dr. Fitzpatrick smiles wide, pinching his tongue between his teeth as he turns away from Ren Jacoby, inhales deeply, and faces the rest of the class.
All right, kids, we're starting a new game today. Who wants to volunteer?
His gaze alights on me, and he comically slaps his hand to his forehead.
Ah, shit, we have a newcomer in our midst. I totally forgot. Fuck, I made cookies too. Eloise, right?
He says, wincing at me. Eloise is a common one. I've had all sorts though. Emily, Evelyn, Elena. Apparently my given name isn't as common in other countries as it is in France.
Close. It's Elodie, like Melody, but without the M.
I smile when I correct him, to let him know I'm not offended. He nods, wagging his finger at me.
A girl sitting a beanbag three people over from me sighs deliriously when the guy spins around to face a whiteboard on wheels, and we all get to see just how tight his gray pants are across his purred ass.
In lieu of any weird stand up and tell us all about yourself nonsense, I'm afraid you'll have to be nominated as volunteer for our game today, Elodie, he says, scrawling my name onto the surface of the whiteboard in red marker. Surprisingly, he spells it correctly first time.
She can't be a volunteer if you nominate her, Damiana gripes, casting a sour look over her shoulder at me. How is that fair? Some of us have been waiting our turn for months, Fitz.
Oh, stop whining. I think we're all tired of the ceaseless droning of your voice, child.
Wow. I mean, I thought it was wild the way Ren spoke to Dr. Fitzpatrick, but honestly, the way he speaks to us is a little out there, too. The doc doesn't come across like a typical professor. He seems like a normal, functioning human being, instead of an academic robot trying to hustle us through the curriculum as fast as he possibly can. It's refreshing. Doesn't hurt that he calls people like Damiana out on her shit when she's being bitchy, either. I think I really like this guy. Until he tells me to come stand in front of the class.
Come on, still?
Water, I supply.
Come on, Stillwater, on your feet, front and center. You've got a job to do.
Mortified, I look at Karina, hoping for a miracle that'll mean I can remain sitting with her. Her forehead creases, an apologetic look on her face.
Sorry, dude, I should have realized he'd do this. Best to just go up there and get it over with.
Erg, what a fucking nightmare. I get up from the sofa so slowly that it feels like I'm wading through glue. Once I'm at the front of the class, I turn around, donning a bright, cheery, fake smile, and I face the class down. In fairness, this is a small class by anyone's standards. There are probably only 15 students lazing around like spoiled cats in Dr. Fitzpatrick's den, which is a relief. What's the game? I ask through my teeth, trying to loosen up the smile a little. Can't look real right now. It's far too tense. I hate this kind of thing. I hate moving schools, and I hate meeting new people, and I hate learning all the new rules. I hate learning all the new games, too. Dr. Fitzpatrick beams as he perches on the edge of the windowsill near Ren's leather couch. He doesn't seem to have a desk in here either.
Anyone care to explain the rules to Elodie, class?
This is entertaining to him. He's actually enjoying being here, teaching his students. In 5 different countries and in 5 different schools, I've never encountered another professor who enjoys his job. A guy in the back, leaning against one of the book stacks, speaks up without raising his hand.
It's a popularity contest, he announces without looking up from the Rubik's Cube he's idly spinning in his hands. You stand up there as directed by our venerated puppet master, and you give us a debate argument. The argument has to be related to books or the English language. If the class argues your debate topic in an entertaining way without Fitz getting bored, you score an automatic A on the next assignment, he says.
Hold up now. What? The doc's going to correct the guy and explain the game properly any second now.
Surely. No.
Dr. Fitzpatrick sits on the edge of the windowsill, smiling quite happily. He doesn't even object to the fact that this kid just called him our venerated puppet master. I don't quite know what I'm supposed to do. I'd love to say I don't really give a shit about my grades here at Wolf Hall. But the sad truth is that the monthly allowance my father loads onto my Amex is directly related to my GPA. I know how it works all too well. I ace my tests and assignments, and I'll have plenty of funds to survive on here. I ding my record, or I don't perform as well as Colonel Stillwater expects me to. Then I'll be left to eke out a very depressing existence on next to nothing. I haven't explored the food situation around these parts yet, but I'm assuming there's a diner or maybe even a cafe, a restaurant if I'm lucky. It'd be nice to dine on edible.